I'm going to be talking about songwriters who won't leave God alone. This is a sort of a lecture adaptation of something I've done here at LaBrie. On Wednesday nights with our students, we do something called Wildcard, which is all it means is that whatever staff member of LaBrie is on for the night, they get to choose what we all do. And sometimes it's watching a film and having a discussion. Sometimes it's reading something aloud. For the past few years, I've been doing this wild card called Songs That Won't Leave God Alone. And it's listening to a bunch of different music and discussing it. Usually songs that have something to do with God or the Christian faith, but not necessarily a positive take. And so this is my attempt to morph that into a lecture. So I'll be listening to quite a lot of songs tonight, some of them quite new, some of them very old. And I want this mainly to be an evening of listening and responding to songs. I have some things to say along the way, but really we want to listen to as much as we possibly can. And it's been agonizing to trim down the playlist to a manageable length for tonight. There's about like 35 songs that were just totally essential earlier this week. Now there's like 12. We're lucky. One of the things that the songs all have in common is that they deal with God in one way or another. They either directly address God, or they address the idea of God, or they address Christianity or the church. And just with a few exceptions, they're not in a favorable light. Each song has its own problem with God. And you may have noticed that the lecture tonight is not called Songwriters Who Can't Stop Praising God. Because most of these people are not Christians at all, and the attitudes range from sort of uneasy with the Christian faith to hostile. But I'm particularly interested in songwriters who don't believe in God, but who keep writing songs about Him, or even songs to Him, some of them year after year. For whatever reason, they can't leave God alone. The questions about God, Christianity, the church, the more I listen to some of these songwriters, it begins to feel like a stubborn itch that won't go away, that they keep scratching at. And one of my questions tonight is why? Why can't people stop scratching that itch? Why keep coming back to God who you don't believe in? So I'm going to start just by listening to a song. I'm going to give a disclaimer that at any moment the stereo might switch off and we'll be cast into silence. And you'll get to watch me fiddle around incompetently. And there's a backup plan, but ideally we'll listen to this on the big speakers and it'll be nice and loud and everything. Before we listen to the song, it's a song by David Bazan. He has a solo career now, but he used to be the front man for the band Pedro the Lion. And Pedro the Lion had some credibility in the indie rock world in the 1990s and early 2000s. Bazan was also a Christian. He grew up in a Pentecostal home in Washington State. I believe his father was a music minister of some kind. Pedro the Lion was not Christian contemporary music. It was they were known for a sort of raw honesty about life and Bazan's struggles with his faith. So his songs had a real heaviness to them. They've been described as songs that sound through a glass darkly. And in recent years, Bazan has left the faith. So he no longer calls himself a Christian. He's called himself an atheist and then called himself an agnostic, various different things. But the song I want to play first is the first track from his album, Curse Your Branches, which is in 2009, which he has described, or which has been described as his breakup album with God and the Christian faith. That being said, he admits, he's been interviewed quite a lot, he admits that he never stops thinking about God. It's completely a part of who he is. And he can't stop almost obsessing about God. A lot can be said about him. It's really worth listening to his music. Some of it's pretty rough and pretty dark, but a very thoughtful songwriter. He's actually the only songwriter tonight who has ever been a committed Christian. of the ones that we're listening to. His songs are soaked with biblical imagery and phrases, so much so that some critics have wondered, of all the non-religious people that are really into his music, how much of it are they really understanding? Because it's so biblical, at least in its language, in its imagery, if not in conviction. So, the song is called Hard to Be, and again, that's the first track on Curse Your Branches.
Hard to be a
So, in this song, he's clearly rejected the biblical explanation for why everyone in the world, including himself, is so screwed up, right? And yet he cannot deny that reality at all. So that's the one thing he sings with conviction in the song, right? That it's hard to be a decent human being. We fail even to be decent. He's not even talking about virtuous. Decent is a really not an ambitious word. but he offers no other explanation. He's just convinced that the biblical explanation is can't be right. And then for me, one of the well, first of all, the sort of metaphor that he uses for losing his faith is graduating, right? He's graduating, but it's not a graduation ceremony in which his family will celebrate or congratulate him in any way. But nonetheless, graduation is a metaphor of moving on to maturity, right? You're not in school anymore. And then another line that I think is significant is just in the bridge where he really paints this picture of humanity being trapped. We're ignorance made us hungry, information made us no good. So there's this sense that Adam and Eve in the garden are hungry for knowledge, which is no way to be. And yet when they eat the forbidden fruit, they're cursed forever. And so this is a picture of God basically trying to trap humanity. I just want to give a couple general thoughts for how to approach this evening. Most of the time, at various different times throughout the lecture, I'll just kind of throw it out to you and say, what do you think of this song? Any responses? But in order to do that, I think it's important that we resist the temptation to form hasty opinions about things. I think something that I've been guilty of at various times when I hear something that I disagree with or that I think is really unfair, I'm immediately like, you know, you want to nail it. The worldview of the artist is so problematic, right? Sometimes, I'm not saying this to disparage any of you, I speak for myself and some conversations I've had. Sometimes Christians try to understand a work of art just enough to know whether it's okay to enjoy it. But no more. And the whole point being, we want to come to a place where we're able to evaluate and judge, and then only then can we either let our guard down and enjoy it, or put our guard up and dismiss it, or walk away, stop listening. So when we approach art this way, we don't actually listen very deeply, and usually we stop listening too early. I think if we form an opinion right away about something, part of us switches off and we don't actually follow through and try to hear everything that's being said, communicated. But on the other hand, if we postpone forming an immediate opinion, we give ourselves time to actually attend to what the artist is trying to accomplish. Whether or not we agree with it, we'll at least know what they're trying to accomplish. And then we actually may understand much better what's going on in the work of art, whatever it is, in this case, some songs. Sometimes, and Flannery O'Connor said this, not me, so take your objections to Flannery O'Connor. Sometimes enjoyment can even come before we totally understand something, and sometimes we only understand something if we first enjoyed it. I can give you the exact quote later if you want me to. One of the ways we can listen and postpone judgment is to hold some questions in mind as we listen, and these are just some things that occurred to me. Questions about the craft of songwriting, first of all. I don't know if there's any people who've written songs here or thought about songwriting as a craft. But basically, does the music, the arrangement, the instrumentation, the melody, even the vocal performance, does it support the words well? Is it a coherent whole? Or does it seem disjointed? Does it not make sense? Does it work as a song? None of these, we're not listening to essays tonight, we're listening to songs. Does it work as a song? To what degree do the lyrics successfully communicate? Sarah Chestnut, who's our resident worker poet here and has done a lot of lectures on poetry, had a term that I really like. Is the imagery crisp? There's something, in other words, that comes across as fresh to you. You haven't heard it a million times. In my words, is the song soggy with cliches, or is it crisp? Sarah's wording is a little better. I've intentionally picked songs that I think were really well written, but you don't have to agree with me. I'm trying not to waste your time by playing a lot of poorly written songs for you tonight. That's my opinion. You may think I'm wasting your time, but anyway, if we really attend to the perspective of each singer, we can ask the question, who is God to them? Now, this is the most important question to ask when you're listening to these songs. Who is God to them? What is the God like that they have in their mind? Can you affirm anything about that perspective? In the last song, there's actually a lot about this song that I would affirm. He is not naive or sentimental about human nature. When he abandoned the Christian faith, he didn't say, "Oh, come on, like nobody's perfect. People are okay, basically, in their hearts." No, he has a grip on the fall probably more profoundly than I do, and yet he's abandoned the Christian faith. So that's something to affirm, right? This is not a small thing. A lot of people would disagree with him who have never come near the church. And so we can look for points of connection, even if they are small. Can you relate in some way? Don't think too much about what your response should be, but what is your response to the song? And another possibility is you may relate perfectly to everything that is said in one of these songs. You may feel like the songwriter like looked into your heart and extracted your feelings about life, and that's fine too. I don't want to assume that everyone is going to object to everything tonight. So as you can see, there's actually a lot to think about, a lot to talk about before we ever make a judgment call about the worldview of the artist, right? Every one of these songs, I think, could be a very, very good start for a very good conversation. But only if we have time to really listen and understand what's going on in the song. So I think as we do that, we'll realize that a lot of these songs are articulating views that many people share about God and the church and the Christian faith today. So this is something that's good to do as Christians, if we're Christians, to understand how do people view what we claim is true. It's an act of love to try to listen and understand some of these. We're going to do another David Bazan song, which is called In Stitches, from the same album. And I won't talk about it ahead of time. We'll just play it. Thank you.
question, you responded, who are you to challenge your creator? Well, if that one part is true, it makes you sound defensive, like you have not thought it through enough to have an answer, or you might have bit off more than you could chew.
Kind of unfair to ask people to respond without having time to process things, but any initial responses to this song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me it seems rather depressing.
You would be right, yeah. No, he's not trying to be happy. Yeah.
Sorry. I would think particularly bringing up Job and the question, who are you to challenge your creator, it seems like and also from the previous song that he sees God as judgmental but not loving.
Mm-hmm.
And then also like the last bit, like you had not thought it through, that God isn't all-knowing, isn't all-powerful.
Figuring things out as he goes along.
Mm-hmm.
And got it over his head.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole brokenness of the world. Yeah.
But it's also a love song.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. One of the brilliant things about this song is that if you didn't know that you were at a lecture about God, and you just heard the first verse, you'd think it was about a woman, right?
Right. Right.
And I think that's what genius move in the song. You're like, yeah, oh, he's drinking, he's lethal drinking. He's trying to forget his ex-girlfriend or his ex-wife, and he's totally depressed, and he's trying to drink to forget. And then by verse two, you're like. You know, this is actually God he's trying to forget about, and he can't. Yeah. But it's very much, I think he's playing with our expectations there. Because 99% of the pop rock songs you listen to are love songs or breakup songs.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's, he's smart. Yeah.
Well, I was on the crew that killed the captain, and you still can hear his voice.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of describing what... All I know about this man is what I've learned tonight.
Yeah.
But it describes the first
song. Yeah. Well, this describes the whole lecture really tonight. Is kind of like this song was like he actually wrote the song for the lecture tonight. I emailed him and said, David, can you come up with something in a week? he's very accommodating. yeah. To me, the verse 2 is so strong. That's where it becomes clear that he's talking about God. The crew have killed the captain. They can still hear his voice. The shadow on the water, to me, that sounds like a reference to Jesus walking on the water after his disciples, and they think he's a ghost, right? And this is about God who's a ghost. Who's gone but still lingering somehow. And God is a ghost to Bazan. That would be one of the answers to the question, who is God to this person? And then his daughter's curiosity keeps pressing God on him, too. He's very honest. I mean, I find him very honest. I mean, this is long walks with your daughter sound so nice, you know? Something that we'll let him forget. Yeah, Sarah, do you have something? Yeah.
I'm just going to say that his use of you, the way, you know, like, he sounds quite accusatory, you know, of God, about you.
Yeah.
And then even the anguish of having your daughter pestering you with these questions. Honest curiosity.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
But then, yeah, and then how it's turned, God turns that. To Job, you.
Yeah.
I don't know the play of the you. I think it's interesting. And I was just as you were talking about the ghost, the piano at the end and hearing the pedal and you know all that. Like, I mean, that was quite striking. I thought it occurs to me like that sort of creates a ghost.
Yeah. You hear the creak. You hear the piano bench creaking. You hear the pedals creaking. Yeah. And it's totally unresolved. It doesn't land on any particular chord. He's just like, and then it kind of ends. That's why I was waiting. I didn't know when to press stop because he doesn't resolve it.
I think also the way the song is, he sounds drunk. But in that first part, he's saying, if you take the stitches, my fingers find the stitches, spreading back and forth they run. If you're thinking of it as the stitches of a book, he's sitting there drunk.
Over
a book, tossing back and forth.
Yeah.
And so it's right there with him, but his thoughts are pushing him all over.
Yeah. And then the title is so interesting. It's In Stitches, which is an expression that refers to laughing uncontrollably, right? So it's just like, it's if that's what you're getting at, there's something deeply sarcastic about the title, right?
When you just said sarcasm, that was what was going through my head the whole time. Like, this guy, every single line is sarcastic and like just this smirk and this, and then he says, "Well, if that one part is true."
I
mean, I think he's talking about the canon. Like, I think he's talking about it. Like, one part of this story is true.
Yeah.
And that line really struck me.
Yeah.
He is hurt.
Yeah.
Deeply.
Yeah.
He is done.
Yeah.
But he keeps coming back.
Yeah. And I think one thing about his use of the word "you," which struck me, is that I think it's different throughout the song. Heading into the after this, maybe full of questions about you. He goes up high, "I'm you," and then this big fall. He's really like wailing. It's not as accusatory there. It's more just kind of like I don't know what it is. Longing for some resolution that's not happening yet. I'm going to keep moving because we could talk about one song all evening, which wouldn't be a waste of time. But let's keep listening to more songs. So this next song is by Iron and Wine, which is the stage name for a guy named Sam Beam, and it's called "On Your Wings." Let's do this. Thank you. I'll begin by saying that there's a lot in this song that I don't understand. Some of the images are very mysterious. Any initial thoughts about the song? What about his arrangement?
People listening. Like clock.
Yeah. It's a relentless. Yeah. There's a way in which the song starts after all the singing is done. The drums and the bass don't even come in until all the lyrics are done, and then it just kind of, there's this outro where you're playing, and then it ends. It's like, it's interesting. I don't know how to explain that.
The slide guitar references that line, how we wither in the shade.
Yeah.
Sounds like withering in the summer.
Sliding down. That's a strong image to me of an image of extreme frailty. You think of plants withering in the hot sun, but he's described, we wither in the shade. This is how vulnerable we are. It's really about death. There's an image of the sea, some strange kind of metaphorical picture of humans being born out of the sea and then dying and going back to the sea. In the second verse, it's sort of divided in half. And all we can really hope for is that we'll have some love in the time between. Right.
Seems very Ecclesiastes-ish.
Yeah.
Nothing new, it's like a cycle. We're small, we die, hopefully.
Right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it. It's he may have been thinking about Ecclesiastes. This is another one of the songs that I can relate to the if God is no comfort to us in death, then yeah, this is basically all we have. Just hopefully give us some love in life before we go. But there's a lot in the world around us that is an obstacle to that love. There's guns growing out of our bones. This is one of the most powerful images in any of the songs tonight, is that. Just, you just think of the violence that we witness every day. And it's not just incidental, it's something to do with human nature. And there's guns growing out of our bones. Somehow every road we're on seems to be taking us farther away from home, but who knows what home is. So this is not, it's a prayer in a sense. He's talking to God the whole time, but God is not offering him hope in any of the things that are most distressing to him. Yeah.
It feels like the use of God here is almost ironic. It's given all the rest of it, we're still praying to a God that we know based on everything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a figure.
Yeah. It might even be an expletive. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gosh, you know, I don't know. Sorry, go ahead.
Besides, probably it's like the last verse, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
About the wings, like, there's an image in the scripture of
hiding
under God's wings and being safe in that shade of his wings and being protected and growing.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm dying in the same spot because he doesn't know where he is.
Yeah.
Like, that's really sad.
Yeah.
Like, the only thing I can feel for him is pity.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what a blessed spot you are in right now.
Yeah.
And all you can see is the shade, and all you can see is the death. You don't realize what you actually have.
Yeah. Like, and I think that's like that's true. I think I find myself sort of deeply saddened, listening to all these songs, weeping alongside them, mostly because of what they aren't seeing. But
you were mentioning death. I think one of the things that strikes me about all three songs is that there is an endlessly unknown. They start talking about things like in this first verse, God, there's gold hidden deep in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There is wisdom somewhere, and I'm not able to find it.
Yeah.
If you just show it to me, because I'm fearing, here comes the hangman. He wants to come around. There's that final end.
Yeah.
It's that death.
Yeah.
Can I find wisdom? Can I find you before the death?
Yeah.
They're talking about the carelessness of this, the careless from the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Calling careless from the sea. But God always talks a lot of, throughout even Revelation, about the sea of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about humanity. We're born. We compare ourselves to things that are doing even better than we, like the ravens.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they can get corn. We can't seem to get wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And the it reminds me of one of my favorite songs, which is going to sound funny, of the movie Old Brother Who Art Thou, where the Grand Master of the Ku Klux Klan gets
death.
It's almost like there's that thing way out there that I'm really wanting to hurry up and find out why I'm here. Why can't I find myself back to God? Mm-hmm. And I'm really a little angry at him because he's not just letting me know.
Yeah.
And yet death is continually creeping up on
me.
And it's a fearful situation.
Yeah.
So it's despair.
Yeah. That we're left with. Yeah. I think it's an example. I think this song and the last David Bazan song are maybe an appropriate word for them would be godless laments. So that they're objections that demand a personal response, but crying out to a God who can't possibly be there. And so somehow someone must be addressed. So the world is so full of misery and injustice and chaos that there somehow needs to be someone to complain to, and not just anyone, not just complaining to our friends and neighbors. Somehow the anguish is deep enough that even a political protest song wouldn't be enough. It would be inadequate. Somehow the one we have to complain to, they have to have enough weight and authority to match the weight of the accusations, right? The world's problems are so big, someone big must be to blame. And it's almost like there's this longing for some kind of transcendent court of appeal. We want to talk to the manager, so to speak. I don't want to talk to, I want to talk to someone just who knows as little as I do. And so if there isn't any transcendent court of appeal, we'll have to accept that our gut response to all the misery has no meaning at all. Our sense that this is deeply wrong, our sense that something is not as it should be, it doesn't really mean anything if all we can do is complain to our neighbor, right? And so I kind of hear some of these songs as temporarily suspending disbelief in order to talk to God. Right? Anna, do you have something?
I just feel like even though the actual music was just kind of this, like, I just sounded so tired to me. But I felt like the first stanza there about rising when we're born on our knees calling for us to see, like, I almost felt like the lyrics do like have this a little bit of hope in there,
mm-hmm.
of like maybe, but mm-hmm. like already with this kind of decided that it's not the answer, is it going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And so then by the time that, I don't know, it turns out I kept on thinking of these, you know, those huge giant turtles that crawl on the sand, like calling careless from the sea, like he's just a very tired hope,
mm-hmm.
and then getting finally to the shade of the trees, and then finding out that that we're withering here,
mm-hmm.
and then like seed that we have, so just mm-hmm. going to death, and but like I just felt like he had already decided that hope was in vain. Like a little flicker of hope.
Yeah, there's something good about life here, but it's short and there's a lot of misery in it. That's what you're saying. Yeah.
And that's why I wonder with the songwriters is why they're writing these prayers in their songs and God's not answering them. Because it seems to me that when God doesn't like speak in answers that people understand,
mm-hmm.
that it might be the process itself that's dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the question that I come to is there something where they're searching for something but not necessarily searching for God?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's not answering the question. Mm-hmm. That's
very possibly. I mean, each person is very different, and their stories aren't over yet. This is one of my prayers, is that this is some of these people, insofar as they are honestly searching for some real answer, that God will somehow respond to them. Maybe not with the answer they had in mind, but mm-hmm. but.
Carl, all the artists make "I Know I'm Still Alive."
Yep. Correct. Yep. Randy Newman is still hanging on. We'll get to him in a minute. He's the most senior of our songwriters.
That's really encouraging to me, especially like to see these honest writers. I mean, assuming they're like really just sharing the truth about their struggle.
Yeah.
To know that the story isn't over. That's really encouraging to me to know that like God can work in any individual's life.
Yeah.
Regardless of what point they come to.
Yeah.
And how they might treat him or refer to him or try and even discredit him to everyone they know.
Yeah.
I've seen it personally, and now to see musicians do it like at this level, it's like it begs me to like pray for them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good response. I mean, important thing to keep in mind here is that these are songs written by people, and we don't want to conclude too much about them from listening to one 3.5 minute song. I mean, first of all, these songs are part of a whole body of work for most of them, and also who knows what they were. They're also a sort of a snapshot into their life at a particular time, and it's worth. Yeah, I don't think we have to sort of confine the view of the artist to what they say in any one song. I'm gonna kind of move on here, and then there'll be some time to keep on talking, but there'll be some more songs to talk about as well. One of the words that's used that I think we could use to describe all the stuff we've heard so far is haunted. So that word has been used to describe David Bazan's music over and over again. People always talk about him as being haunted. Personally haunted by God, and then God sort of passes through many of his songs in a ghostly sort of way. There's a wonderful quote by Flannery O'Connor. It's an essay about Southern literature. She's talking about aspects of the grotesque in Southern literature. And I'll read the whole quote, but particularly focus on the bold part there. Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it is because we are still able to recognize one. To be able to recognize a freak, you have to have some conception of the whole man. And in the South, the general conception of man is still, in the main, theological. That is a large statement, and it is dangerous to make, for almost anything you say about Southern belief can be denied in the next breath and with equal propriety. But approaching the subject from the standpoint of the writer, I think it is safe to say that while the South is hardly Christ-centered, it is most certainly Christ-haunted. The Southerner who isn't convinced of it is very much afraid that he may have been formed in the image and likeness of God. Ghosts can be very fierce and instructive. They cast strange shadows, particularly in our literature. In any case, it is when the freak can be sensed as a figure for our essential displacement that he attains some depth in literature. It's just one snippet out of a broader essay. But that line, the Christ-haunted South, was the title of a book about Flannery O'Connor's writing that came out a number of years ago. She's talking about Southern culture in general, but something like this kind of hauntedness, I don't know if that's a word, but hauntedness is going on in these songs. And when we think about what the word haunted means, it means that someone has died, first of all, right? but they're not quite gone. They're still hanging around. There's something hanging around. There's a lingering presence that's not entirely welcome. Nobody's glad that their house is haunted. Nobody's glad to see their dead, you know, father visit them. So there's fear and dread associated with being haunted, and you sort of wish that person who has died would really be dead and gone. Think of Ebenezer Scrooge saying, "Trouble me no longer, these spirits." So in Flannery O'Connor's words, I think God is casting strange shadows in the songs of these songwriters. He's hard to pin down. He's never quite in focus. Very often, he's not actually the God that the Bible describes, I don't think. It's something else. but still, God is a shadowy presence. And I think we live in an age where the assumptions of many people are basically secular in this country. Or belief in God, in the God of the Bible, is thought to be debunked sufficiently And so talk about God in the public square is often unwelcome. It's a private thing. Faith should be a private thing. But in art, I think, maybe even particularly in music, it kind of provides a space in our culture which God can still be addressed in a serious way, even by people that don't believe he exists. So I just wonder whether the reason why so many people who really are working at their craft are sort of turning to address God is that something about the imagination, because we're dealing with the realm of the imagination here. People aren't writing systematic essays here. People are trying to make art. And this, you wonder whether it's something about the human imagination that has almost a muscle memory that bends towards its creator, the one who invented the imagination. Even if it's bending towards the creator to insult him and undermine the Christian faith, songwriters, artists oftentimes turn to the transcendent, to contemplating the transcendent, either negatively or positively. A book that we often talk about here is a recent book by James K.A. Smith, How Not to Be Secular. He's kind of summarizing some of the thinking of the philosopher Charles Taylor, who wrote a very, very, very large book called The Secular Age. And so James K.A. Smith summarizing is very nice for us. Charles Taylor refers to the secular age as being dominated by the immanent frame. So immanent means the here and now, what can be seen and touched and measured and quantified and controlled. And in this context, there are two kinds of hauntings that are happening in our culture. People of faith, because we live in a secular age, are haunted by doubts. In a way, maybe that 400 years ago, people might not have been in the same way, at least. Doubts that maybe God was just invented by people after all. But there's also a second kind of haunting. People with no faith in God are haunted by the possibility that maybe he is real after all. And this is what Charles Taylor calls the transcendent haunting the immanent frame. We all live in this immanent frame. This is the sort of modern Western culture that we live in this country. But it's haunted. People say things like, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. Or I don't believe in God, but I can't get rid of my misgivings. And so the haunting goes both ways. I think, particularly in David Bazan's music, you see both happening somehow, ironically, both at the same time sometimes. He's a person who's chucked his faith that has misgivings, and he's very honest in his interviews that he still is terribly afraid of going to hell. Out of one side of his mind, and then the other side of it says, "Well, if that's how God is going to get me back by scaring me with damnation, then expletive him." That's his response. We're going to listen to another song, something completely different now. It's time for a country song, everybody. Not a typical country song. If anybody gets up and leaves right now, then I'll know how you feel about country music. This is actually a song by a songwriter named Brandi Clark. I think she won something big for this album. And it's called Pray to Jesus. Our kids, how hard was that? Then I find her so interesting because she's got that sort of polished country sound, everything about it, and then her lyrics are just kind of like in a way that most country songs are not. So I appreciate Brandi Clark.
What's your name?
Brandi Clark. There's a lot of insights in this song, I think. Any initial responses?
It's just so sad and funny because it's so small.
Yeah.
You know, it makes life so small.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a reality to that.
Mm-hmm.
Life has just made us a whole lot of small things.
Yeah.
She's also relating your chances of being. Of your prayers being answered.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see how are those two things, are they on the same level? Are they conflated as sort of one of the same, like just Hail Mary kind of hope?
It's like complex view of products.
Yeah. Well, so to me, when I first listened to this, I'm like, oh, well, she's saying that this, like you were saying, same chance of being heard by God as winning the lottery. They're just the same thing. And then, by the end, particularly the verse that talks about going to the mini mart, behind the counter up there on the wall, and raise 200 million on the Powerball, six little numbers that could change it all. So we pray to Jesus. It becomes clear that, at least in that verse, Jesus is a means to what could really change your life, right? It's what we call instrumental religion, you know, where you're not actually worshiping God, you're praying to God to sort of be a means to some other thing that you want much more than God, which is what we do with idols, right? You know, God is great as long as he can get me what I actually want.
But I remember saying that there ain't no tea.
Right.
All through the song.
Yeah.
There ain't no puddle.
Praying against
me. Is that, I'm wondering whether to her, to pray to God really expecting a response in a tangible way is like praying to genie in a bottle. It's the same ridiculous kind of scenario.
Or in lieu of genie, pray to Jesus.
right. Yeah. If there was a genie in a bottle, that would be much more expedient.
Yeah.
I think
there's
one verse that really speaks to me in the whole song, the despair in that part where it says, you don't want to be buried. And there's two things we're totally, terribly afraid of.
Yeah.
Being poor and homeless,
yeah.
Or dying in our sins.
The
pivotal point of that song.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is like, okay, it's just going to keep playing.
The response to those two big fears. Right? Yeah.
What are the two big fears?
Being in debt and being in sin. So being in debt and homeless, not having any money, or dying in your sin. In this line right here.
Yeah.
I think it's a very southern idea.
Yeah.
Sort of over so many people I know, southerners that don't believe in God, but are afraid they're going to go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, it's so deeply ingrained, the idea of sin and God's judgment.
Just part of the haunted.
God will be
haunted
for a long time before that idea will go away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think a big number of the South, especially the southern churches, they it's more on hell and damnation. It's more of fire, you know, brimstone preaching of the past. And it's been that way since the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And the not understanding that it is a free gift of God.
Mm.
It's grace.
Yeah.
you're constantly trying to do something to earn that,
yeah.
And it can't be earned.
Yeah.
And a lot of, if you don't understand it, then you don't know how to, you're trying to buy your way back to God. It totally creates a despairing situation.
Yeah. And a fear of hell, right?
And a fear of hell.
If you know you can't do it. Yeah.
It's like paying for a stairway to heaven. It's just absurd.
Yeah.
It feels like we've come a long way from the anguish of David Bazan here. There's a lightheartedness. I mean,
there is a lightheartedness, yeah.
All that, but
yeah.
Still, there's a spark here,
yeah.
A playfulness here.
That's one of my questions of Brandi Clark, is whatever you think here, is what's her... So she's diagnosing something. Is it a problem to her? I assume it's ironic where she says it ends with, let's pray to Jesus, let's play the lotto. I mean, she's like, she's encountering herself in all of this. Let's just keep doing it. I hear it as very sarcastic, because she's pointing at something that's basically hypocritical, in a sense. You know, we talk about God actually really being there and being someone who hears our prayers and responds in tangible ways, and yet you hedge your bets because you can't really expect him to do anything.
Just a line about after church we hit the mini mark. I mean, it just strikes me, just banality.
Yeah.
It's so banal. And church, which in the biblical sense is, you know, meeting together with the angels and God, and something really transcendent happening. And it's just on some level of the mini mark and the pinball.
But both are a place of worship. I mean, that's one of the things that I sense here. Like, go to church, and then you go to your second church, which is because that's what could change. It doesn't say we pray to Jesus who could change it all. It's those six little numbers that could change it all, right? And so, like, who is the God of that, particularly that last verse? So the God is money. That's what the God looks like. That maybe is oversimplifying, but in terms of where is our hope resting, you know, even if it's a totally long shot hope, 1 in 2 million chance, where's your heart? Like, where are the desires going? Well, the mini mart is equally a place of worship to church, at least in her presentation of it.
So, yeah. Yeah. How do you read that, the recurring phrase, because there ain't but two ways, we can change tomorrow? What's your...
Yeah, well, I don't... In some ways, I think she's talking about we're stuck. You know, we're stuck in, you know, the first two verses.
It goes back to greed and debt. There are only two ways to solve that problem.
Is
to either win the lotto and not be up your eyeballs in debt, or be saved by Jesus.
Right.
And have that come through.
But there's not a lot of hope that either will actually come, right?
The two ways were death, which is, yes, you pray to Jesus that you might die, or you win the lotto.
Right. That's a good question.
I think the way to equate the fact that you know, be saved is as far off as the winning the lotto, there's where the conundrum comes in, the really hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that Jesus is the chances of being saved are as far off as winning the lotto, worse than Christian joy.
To me, I can't quite put my finger on what's going on. Like, to me, that's one way of thinking about the song, and the other way of thinking about the song for me is it's not so much about salvation, it's just I'll pray to Jesus if he's going to help me win the lotto. Right. So it's not. What's expedient here is to pray to God or to keep buying tickets.
You know.
Danny. Yeah.
It's also playing the lottery and praying, I guess, for the bed at the bottom of the left hand column in the north. We tell our kids, it's really hard to see. How hard it was back when they were the bottom.
Same way our parents did to us back then, yep.
This sort of tradition of playing lotto and praying, to get us out of this, the banality of it all.
Yeah.
Like, with the same rap that we've been doing.
Yeah.
Oh, let's just do the same thing. No, we'll pray to Jesus. We'll play a lot of hope.
It's our culture. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Also, though, like, she's not saying pray to Allah or pray to the Force, but she knows that if there was any chance at all, Jesus would be her chance. So, like, if she continues to think about that, maybe someday she'll actually believe that there could be a chance in the end. That is interesting to me. Like, through all this, like, she knows there's no, she feels like there's no hope in either of them, but at least she's saying, we know that Jesus could potentially maybe someday, maybe he used to have hope, so we can
pray to
him. It's the only thing that maybe might work.
There's the other analogy that we caused our debt. I mean, we're the ones that caused the debt. The physical debt, the monetary debt. And when she goes up there and she says, grow up, get married, and it didn't work that one, we'll just sleep around and go get married again.
Yeah.
We also caused the sinful debt. So it's like neither one of those are in our own power to solve. So we pray to Jesus.
Well, a lot of the language in the song is about being stuck, right? We're stuck financially, we're stuck in that we're just repeating what our parents did to us and said to us. We're in a tradition. We're just obeying our culture and our heritage, and there's nothing we can do to break out of it. I'm gonna keep on moving. I want to get to Josh Ritter. Josh Ritter writes about all kinds of things. He's an excellent storyteller in his songs. Extremely witty. Nothing like the kind of torment of David Bazan. He's much more playful, but he's no less preoccupied with God and Christianity. And so I'm going to play this next song. It's called Getting Ready to Get Down. And it's, to warn you, there's a lot of words that come really, really fast. And so do your best. The words will be on the screen. And we can go back and we can talk about it at the end.
Get down.
great ending. I don't know how he performs that. Just, yeah. So, very funny song, undeniably clever in a lot of ways. Josh Ritter grew up in a Christian home. Both his parents were neuroscientists. Were quite open to discussing ideas, but were Christians. He doesn't actually come from the hyper-conservative, anti-intellectual, legalistic kind of background that you would assume he did from some of his songs, right? Any observations about the million things to talk about in this song? Obviously, we'll have to shift back and forth between three screens, but any initial thoughts here? And just so you know, I may be sort of clipping the discussion short as we go, just because there's more to get to. But yeah.
Just kind of quite get what getting ready to get down.
Yeah.
Right? Or did you show us getting down?
No. Well, what do people think about getting get down? What does that mean? Anybody?
Have fun.
Break all the rules.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of Josh Ritter's songs, this one included, there's kind of this assumption that the Bible, God, Christianity in general, is a big wet blanket on young people's sexual desires. So one of the sort of threads throughout the song is like this young girl is waking up sexually, and the church is like, we better fix you and send you away to this Bible school, right? And so getting down has some kind of sexual connotations to it. Why would he choose? I mean, he's not singing from the perspective of that girl, but that girl is the main character in the song. Why do you think he chose to do that?
I think he wants to get down with the girl.
Maybe.
I kind of thought that was like a long pickup line.
Yeah. not to mention Billy Joel or anything, but you know the song "Only the Good Die Young." It's a similar thing. It's a song where he's just trying to seduce this Catholic girl who's uptight.
Yeah.
The whole song is maybe a similar thing. Yeah. So yeah.
I think Josh Ritter, of course, has written. He's kind of had a trajectory of his career, but
yeah.
I really feel like this one's very clever, but also yeah. His caricatures, well, they're that,
yeah.
And they're very plastic here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the overprotected teenage girl in the mm-hmm. Bible Belt
yeah.
versus you go to college and now you're wild and that's liberation. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've heard this before.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very skillful
yeah.
rendition of it.
But, I find it to be a little bit of yeah, a caricature and then some cheap shots. I remember I played this for some students a couple terms ago, and I opened up with that reflection. I'm like, is this a cheap shot? Is he actually really being fair here, or is he just like loading every stereotype he can into the canon and then, you know? And then one guy who was here, who's from a very, very conservative upbringing, said, it's absolutely accurate. Like, there's nothing caricatured about this at all, and he's just nailing all these things. So I was like, okay, well, I have a different Christian experience than you.
Yeah, Marty. They send her off to Bible school in Missouri, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. She comes back. They tried to fix her at Bible school. She comes back liberated.
That's a very common idea among conservative Christian parents. That
mm-hmm.
you can send your child to a safe place.
Yeah.
Or maybe if you just keep them at home and homeschool them forever, they'll be safe.
Yeah, yeah.
But lo and behold.
Yeah. Yeah, there's to me the song is full of all kinds of very, very common attitudes that I think I don't know, to me it borders on some cliches at times, but it's so fast and it's so clever that I'm kind of okay with it. The part that says Eve ate the apple because the apple was sweet. What kind of God would ever keep a girl from getting what she needs? And it's just so fast, and that question is so common. Not that specific question, but the what kind of God would dot 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 dot. You know, there. What's implied there is if God doesn't do what I like or give me what I want, he must not exist. Like, if my behavior isn't okay before him, he loses his right to exist. What kind of God? So the assumption is very much, I believe in a God that suits me. And if he doesn't suit me, then he can't possibly be real, because how could my desires not be okay, right? So this is, yeah.
I feel like he's also speaking to, like, a gap in the theology of the people that he's
talking
with.
Yeah, yeah.
When he speaks to, Mom, we got to look at you, and we got a little worried.
Yeah.
He's speaking to the lack of a cohesive worldview that mm-hmm. is able to understand a person who's trying to explore the things that she hasn't dealt with before in her past. And
mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a deep, like... There's one, like, a surrogacy of God in the mama papa past,
mm-hmm.
in like a relation of, oh, these people can't understand, so God probably can't understand
mm-hmm.
because these people are all wrong and God's also all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like mm-hmm. there's it's something very strong about, like, how much these people don't understand the character of God.
Yeah, and those three opening lines. The assumption there is, They just get a look at her and they can tell what her spiritual state is, right? I mean, it's describing a very superficial, you know, I know whether you are in good standing before God, how you dress, what you do, you know, like all these very superficial, very legalistic kinds of criteria for what constitutes being in trouble or not, you know. And, there's another series of lines here. Yeah. Anyway, this is one of those things where maybe one of the reasons why I don't get too offended by this kind of song personally is because if that's your experience of the church, then I'm with you. That sounds pretty terrible. Like, it's not like he's hitting me close to home or close to the heart, as in, and with some of the other songs too, my first response is, well, if that's what you mean by God, then I don't believe in that God either. Right? And there's all kinds of ways in which he's being unfair here, maybe, and caricaturing people, but if that was your experience, then I can understand. Not to say that I agree with his kind of what could be wrong with loving anybody who you want, what kind of God could ever tell you no. You know, those are statements to really push back on hard, but obviously the if this was a true experience of somebody...
It bothers me as much as anything is the... You know, this is a... Somebody grew up in flyover country, Idaho.
Yeah.
Has been living in Boston and then in Brooklyn for the past 10 years. There's a cultural elitism there also.
Well, that's true.
You may not hear as much being in the Northeast. That's how we think about flyover country.
Right. I'm going to just keep pressing on. There's a lot more to say about Josh Ritter's music, as well as some more, dark criticism of the Christian faith. But we can talk about it later if you want. I'm just going to keep going because we haven't even gotten to Randy Newman yet, which we have to get to. So, Randy Newman, yeah, before he dies, we got to talk about Randy Newman. So Randy Newman... let's go skip a couple things here.
How did he ever sing it so fast?
That's a good question. Because he can, I guess. Randy Newman has been writing pop music since the late 60s. He's from a non-religious Jewish family. He was born in New Orleans and then moved to Los Angeles. His family was very plugged into the entertainment business in Hollywood. His uncle wrote the theme song for 20th Century Fox. That's Randy Newman's uncle. He started writing songs, trying to get picked up by record labels so his songs would be performed by other people. Sooner or later, early in his career, he started actually performing his own songs. And they were very weird and disturbing. And people didn't quite know what to do with them. But he has a parallel career of writing film scores. So he does a lot of orchestration for films. He wrote a bunch of songs for Pixar movies, the animated films. Best known for You Got a Friend in Me, the Toy Story. But then he has this the other half of the parallel career is these really bizarre, dark, kind of disturbing songs that don't get played in kids' movies. So he basically believes that God is a human invention, but he keeps on writing songs about God because it's such a big idea. It's the biggest idea people ever came up with, that there's a transcendent God out there. And so it's worth attending to as a songwriter. And that's what he said in interviews. So this first song is called Old Man. It's I forget when it was recorded, but it's, I think, the 1970s at some point. It's fairly early in his career, when he looked more like that. It's a grown son coming to the deathbed of his father. That's the context of this song. And so you picture an old man in a hospital bed, unconscious or half-conscious, and this is the son speaking. That's the last song. Whoops. Not that one.
Everyone is gone away. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? No one cares enough to speak. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? You must remember me, old man. I know that you can if you try. So just open up your eyes, old man. Look who's come to say goodbye.
The uplifting Randy Newman. Let's say a couple things about this song. Randy Newman is a master of irony in his arrangements and how he actually performs the song. And he's got this gentle little like whispery voice the whole time, but it's this. There's an edge of cruelty throughout the whole song, right? There is the sense that the father might not have been a very kind man, and so the son's refusing to show him kindness now, right? It's the line that says, you want to stay, I know you do, but it ain't no use to try, because I'll be here and I'm just like you. Mm-hmm. Goodbye. But the thing that to me is significant about this song is that the son, whether you hear him as cruel, ruthless, whatever, is being brutally consistent. He's essentially saying, why be sentimental and pretend God exists, something we never believed before, just to make dying easier? So if God didn't exist before when you felt really strong and on top of things, then he doesn't exist now when his presence would be a comfort. So I'm not going to pretend that we believe in God. You taught me not to believe that lie. You said it yourself. And so, essentially, it's just, I mean, this is the thing I preach about this song. He's refusing to live a life of denying God, and then at the end get sentimental about it and be like, wow, this should be so nice. You know, so sure, you'll, you know, I'll see you in heaven, Dad. And it's a typical kind of Randy Newman stunt to pull, where it's just it leaves you just kind of like cringing at the end and with no explanation.
And it's chords, the two chords at the end.
Yeah, and then the orchestration is in the beginning, earlier the strings are totally consonant, sweet. They're actually, it's really reminiscent of one of the string parts from Toy Story. He probably plagiarized himself there. And so it's us bordering on, it's not bored, it's like sentimental sounding. It's like, oh gosh. And then at the end, the piano cuts out and the strings build and it ends with that just crunch, so that totally dissonant chord. And that's how it ends. And so to me, this song is not, it's deeply troubling and disturbing, but it's also, I think, him trying to be trying to point out the flaw in sentimentally turning to God when you don't just because it suits you in a moment, when you never actually really believed in him. And so he's refusing to be sentimental here. And I'm going to move on to another song by Randy Newman. We are going to take a turn toward, at the very end, towards a couple of more uplifting songs, but this one right now is, what time is it, first of all? Good. We'll do this one and then one more afterwards. I'm just kind of editing as I go because there's so many good songs to listen to. So this is a very well-known song that he wrote called God Song, and this is where you get a little bit of the term that comes to mind is God the Cosmic Sadist. Here.
Christians and the Jews, the have a tambourine. Listen to him do it on satellite TV. Pick the four greatest people. They began to speak. Said, Lord, praise is all the world. Lord, no man is weak. Temples that we built in, tumbling to the sea. Lord, if you won't take care of us, won't you please, please let us be? And the Lord said, and the Lord said, I burn down your cities, I blind you must be. I take from you your children and you say, bless it all. You all must be crazy. Put your faith in me. That's why I love mankind. You really need me. That's why I love mankind.
So this is the only song we've heard so far where it's God talking. And again, a reminder that this is coming from somebody that doesn't believe there is a God. But if there was, this would be what he was like, maybe. I don't know. I think the thing that's most disturbing to me about the song is what's implied by the word love. His love for mankind consists of being amused by the folly of mankind. So mankind functions as comic relief for heaven. And when really God is recoiling in horror from the foulness and the squalor and the filth and the misery. God doesn't want anything to do with the misery. He's causing the misery, but just standing back, laughing that these people still somehow come back and praise me. This is ridiculous, right? And to me, I think one of my responses to this song, although I don't assume that everybody would respond this way at all, it's such a thorough and a brilliantly written articulation of the opposite of the truth. So to me, I hear the song and I end up being like, I end up like digging my heels in. I'm like, no, that's not. And I end up being more convicted of the goodness of God whenever I listen to this song. Because like, that's not it. I think particularly when you think about the coming of Christ into the filth and the squalor and the misery, it's just precisely the opposite of what the God who is there thinks about humankind. And but this is Randy Newman. He's never easy to pin down. He never has a little label at the end of the song saying what he meant. So on one level, this is saying God's out there. He's a cosmic sadist. On the other level, he's saying you really need me. God is an idea that he thinks people just really need. And so they keep on worshiping him, even though he's not there at all. But let's just pretend for a moment that he is there. And he's laughing up there at how badly you need him, this person who is killing your children and, you know, destroying your cities. And his songs are never one-dimensional. They're very, very complex and multi-layered and ironic. And so not that you'd want to listen to this over and over again necessarily, but they do bear lots of listening. I'm going to play something totally different now and try to lift us out of the... the squalor, the filth, and the misery. I can say it's something completely different. By Sufjan Stevens. Which he gets a picture all to one screen because it's a nice looking guy. There wasn't room for the picture, there's so many words. I don't remember what track it is here, but.
Things I brought, you could have found out you had to get to run alone. Your father cried on the telephone, and he drove his car into the Navy Yard just to prove that he was sorry. I pressed up against your shoulder blade. I can see what you were reading. All the glories that the Lord has made, and the complications you could do without, when I kiss you on the mouth. Take
I'm not going to say much about this song, but just the, it's sort of the series of three-line vignettes, the whole thing, but with a story that kind of carries through about a childhood friend who's dying of cancer. He has a very sort of innocent romantic relationship with, it seems, but picture of God in the story is really interesting. And I find myself relating to it a lot, because he, in the very end, he says, "All the glory when you took our place." When he took our place, it's reference to the cross of Christ. But he takes. So there's this nuanced picture of who God is, or what it is to existentially live in the world in which God is there. He's the source of all the glory, but nothing happens when they pray for healing. You know, and so it's complicated when you see his face. The complications when I see his face. And this to me is something much closer to what it is to really be a Christian living in the real world. It's God is there. He's real. He took our place, but we're still living under the shadow of the fall, as we would say. Yeah.
The shadow of the fall.
Yeah.
What's under that? You said
all of life, all of existence is affected by the brokenness of the world, and so I find this song neither sentimental and naive nor hopelessly cynical. And he's a believer. He's a Christian. He's not somebody that has chucked his faith out the window, but he writes really interesting songs. So, this lecture was entitled "Songwriters That Won't Leave God Alone," and the image I've had in my mind for some of these other songwriters is that, like, there's a dead animal that you can't help like poking with a stick over and over again, but. It seems to me, and this is my hope listening to a lot of this music, it's actually the other way around. This is God poking these people with a stick. It might have been better titled, "Songwriters Who God Won't Leave Alone," because they're chewing on this again and again and again. And hopefully it was real genuine interest in understanding the truth. So, a phrase that we say a lot of Libri is in what ways does reality push back when we're denying the reality of God? In what ways does reality push back on that? And I think some of the things we've seen is suffering of real life pushing back, and our impulse to say why and to want to lament to somebody. That's one way in which reality pushes back. Death itself comes up again and again in these songs. Is there any comfort at all when we face death? Is all comfort naive sentiment? What about our own brokenness, our own cruelty, and our own folly? What do we do with that when we know we're scoundrels and can't really change ourselves? David Bazan continues to appall himself over and over again and keeps writing about it. Desire for meaning when there's a felt lack of meaning. These are all ways in which reality pushes back. Sometimes in good ways, a capacity for wonder or a desire to somehow say thank you for the beauty of the world, and there's no one to thank. That's one of the other ways in which God haunts the secular world. Many, many, many people have an impulse to give thanks, but not everybody believes that there's a giver to talk to. So gratitude is really trendy in our culture now, but it's one of the ways in which God is haunting our culture, because the question should arise, who is there to say thank you to? That's where I'm going to end, because I know I've kept you here very late, and I've tried to break it up as much as possible so it's not just my voice the whole time. But I would like to just throw it open to discussion here, and anyone who needs to leave, feel free to leave. You will offend nobody, but anybody who wants to stay and keep on talking is fine. We can even listen to more music, but this is the official end of the lecture. And
So this is kind of a general comment, and it's sort of focused on sort of a reaction to God. I kind of explore to what extent is this a reaction to the church. And mm-hmm. I think these are mostly, this is an American culture thing.
Yeah.
So the church in America. And and what are we supposed to be learning about that? I mean, I think it's so important. This is an opportunity, like a lot of opportunities, for us to sort of see in the mirror, mm-hmm. you know, and you could look at this as how the culture is wrestling with God.
Yep.
But, I mean, to what extent do we own the reputation of God?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God told ancient Israel that because of them, his name was blasphemed among the
mm-hmm.
nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so to what extent some of this, I mean, to what extent have we served up an infantile gospel, mm-hmm. a narrow gospel, a mm-hmm. Lotto and Jesus gospel?
Mm-hmm.
And in the very first one, Hard to Be.
Yes.
Can you flip back to that?
Sure, yeah.
Because I was really struck because it seems like he's sort of dealing with God in the chorus until the very last one. And then it's sort of the categorization and the judgment mm-hmm. of his family, or by extension the church. And that it's hard to be a decent human being in the eyes of
yeah.
the rest of you.
Yeah.
So I yeah. just sort of, I think that's an important dimension to explore here. So yeah. it's a general comment about.
Yeah, it is an interesting insight into that, into the end of the song. Before that comment, it's hard to be a decent human being. It's just a spoken.
Yeah.
But then at the end, it's no congratulations from my faithful family, some of whom are already fasting to intercede for me, because it's hard to be. Or to be a decent human being. In their eyes, to be a decent human being is to be a faithful Christian, church attending, you know. And it's a very big and complicated question, I guess. But I would say this is one of the reasons why I think it's so important to listen to music like this and to try to understand it. And because whether the criticisms are fair or not, the perception of this perception of Christian and the church, which has fueled a lot of this, I think particularly the Josh Ritter song probably is a lot, just and the Brandi Clark song about praying to Jesus. It's speaking into a culture that has emphasized the legalism side. And
or even just the narrow fire insurance.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm broken. I need a private spirituality.
Yeah.
I need, like, moral rectitude.
Yeah.
Something needs to fix me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just being saved from something and not for something.
Yeah.
And it's just that kind of narrow yeah. gospel kind
yeah.
of view of things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's on one level, it should spur us on to teach a fuller picture of what the gospel actually is, but also to have conversations with people who think this. Because, I mean, it's all well and good if we have a robust understanding of the gospel, that we're not just saved from damnation. We're saved to a certain kind of life, and which is founded on grace. And but unless we're taking some of this stuff seriously first, and taking seriously the impression that Christianity has made, then I don't think that the robust gospel is going to have any effect. I mean, I find myself listening to all these songs, just wishing that I could have a conversation with each one of these people, and many conversations, and not just going like, oh, I listened to that song, and now I have like something to say to this guy, but there's so much behind all of these songs, so many experiences. There's an amazing, there's another song by Bazan. I don't think I have the words printed up, but it's called Bearing Witness. And he's asking the question, what does bearing witness mean? And you can tell there's this huge backstory. He doesn't ever say it, but he's been told his whole life that he has to bear witness to Christ. He has to go out and evangelize. He has to do all this stuff that he's not sure about. And so that's an example of kind of this, you know, for better or worse, what he's grown up with, and it's he's using it in his songs, but this is a much longer conversation to have than we can come up with after listening to any one song, I guess. I don't know. Any other responses to that question? Because it's a huge. You're right that on some level, we can't control people's impression of God, but people's impression of God has a large part to do with the church and Christians' behavior, and maybe bad teaching that's gotten out, and so, does anybody else, because it's a massive question, anyone have a better response? Yeah.
I feel that like this speaks strongly to the kind of like intellectual dishonesty in a lot of the cheap grace movement mm-hmm. of the latter half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a very strong dissatisfaction amongst the millennials
mm-hmm.
with parents who didn't share a faith that they owned. Mm-hmm. They shared a faith that they couldn't own because they never understood it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
They were sharing an inherited faith
mm-hmm.
that they tried to pass down without any knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had to be rules because they never met Jesus in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so I think there's a lot of... It's dissonance and dissatisfaction with the intellectual process and the spiritual search mm-hmm. of the generation that preceded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this speaks a lot to going deep in our relationships with God, and
mm-hmm.
it speaks to certainly the value of a place like Le Brie.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I think that just hearing you say that reminds me that it's... each one of these people have completely different objections to the Christian faith, different reasons. Some of them probably based on scientific discovery that they think it sort of makes Christian belief obsolete. But a huge part of what is missing, and maybe is behind a lot of these songs, is an understanding of the faith which is primarily negative, which is what you do not do, and you're motivated by what you fear will happen to you if you don't. I think one of the saddest things about we've talked to many people at Le Brie who've experienced this, is no connection of positive desire with God and the faith. In other words, I am drawn to God by my desire, by beauty, by a longing that he can satisfy. That's one way to be motivated in life. Another way to be motivated is to be running away from something behind you towards God. I'm turning to God because I'm mostly afraid of going to hell. And you sense that a lot of David Bazan's attitudes, whether or not that was what he was taught, that's what's has driven him to cynicism and ultimately away from God. A lot of the conversations have been happening in recent years, but not in recent years. It's been happening all along. But even C.S. Lewis's writing, and much more recently, James K.A. Smith talking about the formation of desires, actually is something that the church has dropped the ball on. Mm-hmm. You think it's about doctrine, believing the right doctrines, having the right information in your head, and then don't do this and this and this. Mm-hmm. That's not enough, right? Growing as a Christian has to do with our desires being formed so that our hearts are actually longing and heading towards God.
We've never talked about, you and I have never talked about your song, Drowning.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't help but think, half baptized is worse than halfway there. What is being spared when you're out of air?
You threatened me you would start quoting my song. Unbelievable. We almost got through this. Yeah, well, that's trying to articulate that same problem. Like, is it enough to just be saved so I'm not damned? Is that what being saved is? Being sort of let off the hook, and that's it, sort of in terms of the theology of baptism, that's only half of it. Which is if you think of the image of going down in the water, that's you dying to your sin. And then the other half is kind of important, because otherwise you're still underwater.
Right.
You're coming back.
Right.
And I think that's just something that a lot of young people have experienced in this country anyway. They're like, great, I'm saved. Mm-hmm. But what? What now? Saved to what? The emphasis has been I'm saved from ... but saved for what? And I think that unless we're thinking about that and talking about that, then we're not connecting with our desire. This is something beautiful towards which we're going. This is what Lee, one of our students, you're reading the Confessions, and I think this is one of the things that's amazing about the Confessions, that there's both going on at once. Augustine is disgusted with his past and wanting to to break free from sin and all these other things, and so he's kind of being this image of getting sort of beaten from behind by God, but then he's also growing in his desires for God, and he's being led by his longings towards something good, and there's both happening at once. And if it was just about him hating himself for his sin and being afraid of hell, then the Confessions never would have been written. But it's both. Yeah, Marty.
Yeah, the second songwriter, there's a line there that the second guy.
The Iron and Wine guy, Sam Bean?
Not the second song, the third
guy. Yep.
There's a line there that really struck me as being, it's a prayer, it's a longing for what's really good. God gave us love in the time that we have, and so I think that's the desire, the longing, what you've just been talking about, which is a longing that, legitimate longing that we're all born with. And I think you can read it both, when you think that it give us, God has loved us, give us the experience of God's love, but also the whole law is summed up in, you shall love the Lord your God with your heart, your mind, your soul, your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. And the longing for love in the time that we have.
Yeah.
I find that a really moving line. That's a prayer that you just pray God will answer for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a longing that we all should have.
Yeah.
Our lives should be characterized by love.
Yeah.
We should be blessed by experiencing love from other people, but also that give us love for the people in our lives, for the people that God wants to for
him. Yeah.
So I just see that as that's a really totally legitimate longing and
expressed
by this guy.
Yeah, I agree. I guess I've heard it. I would say definitely. I guess what I've heard that line mostly in the light of the time that we have, which is and then we so. Meaning the time that we have is all we have. And so it's not spoken in the context of any hope for an afterlife or anything, but still it's a very good prayer. I have no idea what he would say about this. I don't know, but
I was thinking about your question earlier about what sort of responses we might have for just like if you're a fuller understanding of the gospel. I really like what you said, and another person or two here as well, about listening really carefully to people, like you just want to have conversations with people that wrote these songs. And I love that you put the photographs up, because I don't know, it just gives me a more human connection with
everything. I was hoping it wouldn't distract from, but I think, I think it's nice.
But one thing that I thought about is that sometimes when we as Christians do talk about things like current trends in our society, like maybe wanting to have a spiritual experience and believe in something of a higher power, but nothing personal. I think some discussions we assume, okay, well, that's because of, you know, a personal God, because a personal God would demand something of them morally, and they're, you know, they want to. And sometimes I think that could totally be the case, but sometimes it's not necessarily. And it could be for other reasons, like I was just thinking of one of my friends who I realized just recently, when we talked about anything of a higher power, I was like, so, oh, you don't believe in a personal God, or you don't want this person to be a person? She's like, exactly. Well, I think I didn't really know what to do with that until I was here this evening thinking about it, and I was realizing, well, yeah, it could be that because she wants to, you know, distance herself from a personal God that would demand something of her, or it could be that a personal God scares her because people have no idea. And so the idea of pushing a person brings up, you know, a gender thing of, like, would it be a man? And I just, like, you know, for a body, like, you speak of, like, a body. And so I think that a nod makes you want to go back and ask yourself, why is it a personal God scares you?
That's a really good question. Because for some people, only a personal God could offer any comfort at all. But then for others, that would be a threat. Or just something that makes deeply uneasy. This is one of the things that I think is so interesting and maybe fruitful about our culture's obsession with gratitude, how healthy gratitude is, psychologically beneficial, better for your health if you keep a gratitude journal, if you spend however many minutes each day reflecting on the good things in your life, but none of it with any connection to a personal giver, and very often for things that you cannot possibly thank another human being for. It's like my breath this morning, you know, like, or even just the sun salutation in yoga, where you said which I've never done and I don't understand, but basically sort of breathing in and breathing out gratitude is part of a discipline, which is I would say that aspect of it's really great. Yeah, we should be thinking about ways in which we are blessed, but all in the context of not a personal giver out there at all. But to me, it's really interesting that for gratitude to make any sense at all, it has to have a personal giver. It has to be responding to gifts that were given on purpose by someone. And that's the big sort of hollow, there's just no foundation under secular gratitude. But it's a great opportunity for an actual positive conversation, because we as Christians are, you know, we can affirm that gratitude is good. And I believe that it's good for your health. I don't have to object to that. But there's a reason why. It's because it's what we were made to do. And there's someone to speak to. I don't. That's interesting. Is she a grateful person? You don't have to.
When I became a Christian, I was most thankful for. I remember lying out in the snow and saying, "Now I finally know who I can thank for who I am." I just had been. It was a really powerful sense. Now, thank you.
And now I know there's so much to thank. You said there's no foundation under secular gratitude.
Yeah. Well, that may be a strong way of putting it, gratitude is a virtue that people that most people really value today, but without a personal God who's given us anything. So,
God can be the same.
But you can't thank the state for the fact that you got up this morning and you can breathe. I mean, there's a lot of daily blessings which are so basic we don't think of them as gifts, but they're without them we'd be dead.
Christy seems to say here any parallel here at all. But we're coming from the sea on our own, just crawling, careless down the way, I said careless, mm-hmm. on our knees from the sea. Mm. But when we leave, we're not leaving on our own. Mm.
Yeah.
It says if that relates to God, it refers to God.
So you're saying that
we're going back.
Yeah.
When we die, we're going back to the sea where we came from. But on your wings, not under our own power. Hmm. Is there any suggestion of evolution in that?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean that had occurred to me. Yeah.
We all,
so like
we all
emerging
the
from the
and they
yeah.
made it on the dry land and changed blah blah blah.
Yeah.
And then we go back.
If it is, I think it's pretty subtle. Yeah, I don't think, or at least it's not heavy-handed. I don't think.
Yeah.
I think careless I hear as being without care, without worry. We're born into this world, and you know, and then.
I don't
know if that's Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I don't know. This song is one of the more enigmatic of the songs we listened to tonight in terms of what the imagery means. Yeah,
we
I'm not sure.
On our own, you're carried back.
You're carried back. Yeah,
power.
Yeah. I don't know.
This is a pretty girl.
Sarah, yeah.
Made that song there.
What?
Yes, the next one or something like that. About the lotto.
Brandy Clark. Yeah. Sarah, did you have a comment about this?
Yeah, it's
yeah.
a question.
Okay, good.
So, just in regards to the sort of the haunting of goodness, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just curious, definitely the Sufjan Stevens song,
mm-hmm.
all the glory,
yeah.
but it's, you know, paired with the tragedy
mm-hmm.
Of life.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm just wondering if there are other songwriters who do not come from a place of faith,
yeah.
but that you would say their music has a genuine haunting of the goodness.
Mm-hmm. Funny you should mention that. Do you want to listen to another song? Yeah, there's a Gillian Welch song, which I think does a good job of that. I'm not sure where it is in my playlist for my finish.
What's the title?
It's called No One Knows My Name. Mm-hmm. And this is a very sort of scratchy, old-timey sounding recording. I think this is would be one answer to that question.
Once on the whole world.
Should be a fiddle there, but we're missing a speaker, so. Right.
And then there's a lonesome thought in my mind. Now and then there's a lonesome thought in my mind. And on the crowded street I see a strange face that looks like me. Now and then there's a lonesome thought in my mind. But anyone stole in the whole world knows my name.
To me, that song is interesting because God is never mentioned, or it's just like the Book of Esther, like all this stuff happens, but no, God is never mentioned. and it's a lonely song, and it's a song that this is actually fairly autobiographical. She was an adopted child, so she has a lot to be thankful for. She has wonderful adopted parents who raised her. And They were writers for the Carol Burnett Show, actually. Her parents. But in any case, she's sort of haunted by this fact that she never knew her mom, never knew her dad, and there's this way in which that doesn't even know her name because of her background and her. And you get the sense there's potential shame connected to that, and yet there's this unbelievable realization that actually she still has cosmic significance because she has a name that's in the sky. It reminds me of, I mean, I'm not sure if this is intentional at all, but it reminds me of in the Revelation 2 where it talks about there's a stone that God has with your name on it. That's how significant you are. But it's not, the song isn't a big hallelujah. It's very, very understated. She's brilliant at understatement. It says, to me, the takeaway line is the second to last line, where she's aware that even though she doesn't even know her name, she has a name. And then there's this lonesome thought on your mind. On a crowded street, I see a stranger's face that looks like me. Now then, there's a lonesome thought in my mind, which is something that as an adopted person that never knew your parents, that kind of says it all in one line, I would think. I'm not adopted, I don't know, but I've spoken to people who are, who said, that's it. You know, wondering, are there people I'm related to that I've never met? And so it's not as if the loneliness of not knowing your blood relatives goes away. But at the same time, she's convicted that she's significant.
Yeah, and she's thankful. Yeah.
And she's thankful. Yeah, yeah.
Thankfulness.
Yeah.
Adopted parents.
So when she says, "I had a good mother and dad," it's the same. She's talking about her adopted parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pro-life song.
It's a pro-life song.
Pro-life song.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
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 Thank God for doing yeah. Well.
To wonder that I'm in this world at all.
Yeah. I think the thing that strikes me about this song is though, you know, she says all this thing about not knowing her name. And she gets to the point where it says, it's written up in the sky and I'll see it by and by.
Mm-hmm.
It almost was reminiscent of God has his book,
mm-hmm.
and he has my name
yeah.
written in this book of life.
Yeah.
I may not know, you know, just physically who I was
mm-hmm.
when, you know, from my original parents.
Yeah.
But I'll know it when I get there.
Mm-hmm.
And better than that, God knows everything about me.
Yeah.
He knows not only my name, but my character, my mm-hmm. authority, my being. Everything mm-hmm. has to do with me. And when I get there, and to see it written right here.
Yeah.
It's, to me, that's the powerful thing about the songs. It's, I've lived this life, and it's almost like the despair of all the other songs, except the one bright and shining hope is there. I know my name is written in the book of life.
And it
turns this song around from everything else.
And she says it in a non-heavy-handed way.
Yeah.
Like, it's very subtle.
Yeah. Wherever everyone else is just leaving the whole thing in despair, she pulls the song completely out of it by declaring someone really does know my name.
Yeah.
And it's the important one.
Yeah. That's probably a good song to end on, I would think. You can listen to some more David Bazan if you want. But she sang all over the soundtrack. This is Gillian Welch is a big part of that. She has a little bit part in it also.
Oh, that's awesome.
Has anyone seen that movie recently? Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Well, Gillian Welch sings on the record a lot. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? But she comes into the general store and asks for Soggy Bottom Boys record. And they're out. They're like, no, we can't keep them on the shelf. And then, anyway, that's Gillian Welch.
One of the ladies at the stream.
She is one of the voices of the lady at the stream, but she's not one of the actors. They hired different people to be the actors than the singers. It's the second time you've mentioned it. It's a great one.
What's the meaning of the title for the Speaking on the song? What does that mean?
I have no idea. I didn't have time to look that up.
Okay. It's the first of March that you mentioned in the song.
Yeah. Yeah, it's some local least significant holiday.
Can you give us a list of the other
35 songs? If you're interested, you can. Not all of them are really appropriate to the lecture. They're just a bunch of things that I chucked into a file. But,
Pedro's rendition of Steve Out My Vision.
I haven't listened to that recently. I listened to it a long time ago. I haven't heard it recently.
Yeah, that was probably my favorite of years ever.
There's just a bunch of stuff. You can come up and look at this afterwards if you want. I'm not going to read the titles off. Well, thank you, everybody. Not as often as I would like.